Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Unlikely Spy by Daniel Silva, performed by Michael Page. Preface. In April 1944, 6 weeks before the Allied invasion of France, the Nazi propagandist William Joyce, better known as Lord Haw Haw, made a chilling radio broadcast directed at Britain. According to Joyce, Germany knew the Allies were at work on large concrete structures in the south of England. Germany also knew those structures were to be towed across the English Channel during the coming invasion and sunk off the coast of France. Joyce declared, "Well, we are going to help you, boys. When you come to get them underway, we're going to sink them for you." Alarm klaxons sounded inside British intelligence and the Allied High Command. The concrete structures referred to by Joyce were actually components of a giant artificial harbour complex bound for Normandy, codenamed Operation Mulberry. If Hitler's spies truly understood the purpose of Mulberry, they might very well know the most important secret of the war, the time and place of the Allied invasion of France. Several anxious days later, those fears were put to rest when U.S. intelligence intercepted a coded message from Japan's ambassador to Berlin, Lieutenant General Hiroshi Baron Oshima, to his superiors in Tokyo. Oshima received regular briefings from his German allies on preparations for the looming invasion. According to the intercepted message, German intelligence believed the concrete structures were part of a massive anti-aircraft complex, not an artificial harbor. But how did German intelligence make such a crucial miscalculation? Did it simply misread its own intelligence, or had it been deceived? Considering the thousands of workers who at one time or another were involved, it was remarkable that the enemy had no inkling of what was afoot. Guy Hartkopf, Force Mulberry. In wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. Winston Churchill. Part 1. Chapter 1. Suffolk, England, November 1938. Beatrice Pym died because she missed the last bus to Ipswich. 20 minutes before her death, she stood at the dreary bus stop and read the timetable in the dim light of the village's single street lamp. In a few months, the lamp would be extinguished to conform with the blackout regulations. Beatrice Pym would never know of the blackout. For now, the lamp burned just brightly enough for Beatrice to read the faded timetable. To see it better, she stood on tiptoe and ran down the numbers with the end of a paint-smudged forefinger. Her late mother always complained bitterly about the paint. She thought it unladylike for one's hand to be forever soiled. She had wanted Beatrice to take up a neater hobby, music, volunteer work, even writing, though Beatrice's mother didn't hold with writers. "Damn!" Beatrice muttered, forefinger still glued to the timetable. Normally she was punctual to a fault. In a life without financial responsibility, without friends, without family, she had erected a rigorous personal schedule. Today she had strayed from it, painted too long, started back too late. She removed her hand from the timetable and brought it to her cheek, squeezing her face into a look of worry. "Your father's face," her mother had always said with despair. A broad, flat forehead, a large, noble nose, a receding chin. At just 30, hair prematurely shot with grey. She worried about what to do. Her home in Ipswich was at least 5 miles away, too far to walk. In the early evening, there might still be light traffic on the road. Perhaps someone would give her a lift. She let out a long, frustrated sigh. Her breath froze, hovered before her face, then drifted away on a cold wind from the marsh. The clouds shattered, and a bright moon shone through. Beatrice looked up and saw a halo of ice floating around it. She shivered, feeling the cold for the first time. She picked up her things, a leather rucksack, a canvas, a battered easel. She had spent the day painting along the estuary of the River Orwell. Painting was her only love, and the landscape of East Anglia her only subject matter. It did lead to a certain repetitiveness in her work. Her mother liked to see people in art, street scenes, crowded cafes. Once she even suggested Beatrice spend some time in France to pursue her painting. Beatrice refused. She loved the marshlands and the dikes, the estuaries and the broads, the fenland north of Cambridge, the rolling pastures of Suffolk. She reluctantly set out toward home, pounding along the side of the road at a good pace despite the weight of her things. She wore a mannish cotton shirt, smudged like her fingers, a heavy sweater that made her feel like a toy bear, a reefer coat too long in the sleeves, trousers tucked inside Wellington boots. She moved beyond the sphere of yellow lamplight. The darkness swallowed her. She felt no apprehension about walking through the dark in the countryside. Her mother, fearful of her long trips alone, warned incessantly of rapists. Beatrice always dismissed the threat as unlikely. She shivered with the cold. She thought of home, a large cottage on the edge of Ipswich, left to her by her mother. Behind the cottage, at the end of the garden walk, she had built a light-splashed studio, where she spent most of her time. It was not uncommon for her to go days without speaking to another human being. All this, and more, her killer knew. After 5 minutes of walking, she heard the rattle of an engine behind her. A commercial vehicle, she thought. An old one, judging by the ragged engine note. Beatrice watched the glow of the headlamps spread like sunrise across the grass on either side of the roadway. She heard the engine lose power and begin to coast. She felt a gust of wind as the vehicle swept by. She choked on the stink of the exhaust. Then she watched as it pulled to the side of the road and stopped. The hand, visible in the bright moonlight, struck Beatrice as odd. It poked from the driver's side window seconds after the van had stopped and beckoned her forward. A thick leather glove, Beatrice noted, the kind used by workmen who carry heavy things. A workman's overall, dark blue maybe. The hand beckoned once more. There it was again. Something about the way it moved wasn't quite right. She was an artist, and artists know about motion and flow. And there was something else. When the hand moved, it exposed the skin between the end of the sleeve and the base of the glove. Even in the poor light, Beatrice could see the skin was pale and hairless, not like the wrist of any workman she had ever seen, and uncommonly slender. Still, she felt no alarm. She quickened her pace and reached the passenger door in a few steps. She pulled open the door and set her things on the floor in front of the seat. Then she looked up into the van for the first time, and noticed the driver was gone. Beatrice Pym, in the final conscious seconds of her life, wondered why anyone would use a van to carry a motorcycle. It was there, resting on its side in the back, two jerry cans of petrol next to it. Still standing next to the van, she closed the door and called out. There was no answer. Seconds later, she heard the sound of a leather boot on gravel. She heard the sound again, closer. She turned her head and saw the driver standing there. She looked to the face and saw only a black woolen mask. Two pools of pale blue stared coldly behind the eyeholes. Feminine-looking lips, parted slightly, glistening behind the slit for the mouth. Beatrice opened her mouth to scream. She managed only a brief gasp before the driver rammed a gloved hand into her mouth. The fingers dug into the soft flesh of her throat. The glove tasted horribly of dust, petrol, and dirty motor oil. Beatrice gagged, then vomited the remains of her picnic lunch, roast chicken, Stilton cheese, red wine. Then she felt the other hand probing around her left breast. For an instant, Beatrice thought her mother's fears about rape had finally been proved correct. But the hand touching her breast was not the hand of a molester or a rapist. The hand was skilled, like a doctor's, and curiously gentle. It moved from her breast to her ribs, pressing hard. Beatrice jerked, gasped, and bit down harder. The driver seemed not to feel it through the thick glove. The hand reached the bottom of her ribs and probed the soft flesh at the top of her abdomen. It went no farther. One finger remained pressed against the spot. Beatrice heard a sharp click. An instant of excruciating pain, a burst of brilliant white light, then a benevolent darkness. The killer had trained endlessly for this night, but it was the first time. The killer removed the gloved hand from the victim's mouth, turned, and was violently sick. There was no time for sentiment. The killer was a soldier, a major in the Secret Service, and Beatrice Pym soon would be the enemy. Her death, while unfortunate, was necessary. The killer wiped away the vomit from the lips of the mask and set to work, taking hold of the stiletto and pulling. The wound sucked hard, but the killer pulled harder and the stiletto slipped out. An excellent kill. Clean, very little blood. Vogel would be proud. The killer wiped the blood from the stiletto, snapped the blade back into place, and put it in the pocket of the overall. Then the killer grasped the body beneath the arms, dragged it to the rear of the van, and dumped it onto the crumbling edge of the tarmac. The killer opened the rear doors. The body convulsed. It was a struggle to lift the body into the back of the van, but after a moment it was done. The engine hesitated, then fired. Then the van was on the move again, flashing through the darkened village and turning onto the deserted roadway. The killer, composed despite the presence of the body, quietly sang a song from childhood to help pass the time. It was a long drive, 4 hours at least. During the preparation, the killer had driven the route by motorcycle, the same bike that now lay beside Beatrice Pym. The drive would take much longer in the van. The engine had little power, the brakes were bad, and it pulled hard to the right. The killer vowed to steal a better one next time. Stab wounds to the heart, as a rule, do not kill instantly. Even if the weapon penetrates a chamber, the heart usually continues to beat for some time until the victim bleeds to death. As the van clattered along the roadway, Beatrice Pym's chest cavity rapidly filled with blood. Her mind approached something close to a coma. She had some sense she was about to die. She remembered her mother's warnings about being alone late at night. She felt the wet stickiness of her own blood seeping out of her body into her shirt. She wondered if her painting had been damaged. She heard singing, beautiful singing. It took some time, but she finally discerned that the driver was not singing in English. The song was German, the voice a woman's. Then Beatrice Pym died. First stop, 10 minutes later, the bank of the River Orwell, the same spot where Beatrice Pym had been painting that day. The killer left the van's engine running and climbed out. She walked to the passenger side of the van, opened the door, and removed the easel, the canvas, and the rucksack. The easel was erected very near the slow-moving water, the canvas placed on it. The killer opened the rucksack, removed the paints and palette, and laid them on the damp ground. She glanced at the unfinished painting and thought it was rather good. A shame she couldn't have killed someone with less talent. Next, she removed the half-empty bottle of claret, poured the remainder of the wine into the river, and dropped the bottle at the legs of the easel. Poor Beatrice. Too much wine, a careless step, a plunge into frigid water, a slow journey to the open sea. Cause of death? Presumed drowned. Presumed accidental. Case closed. 6 hours later, the van passed through the West Midlands village of Whitchurch and turned onto a rough track skirting the edge of a barley field. The grave had been dug the previous night, deep enough to conceal a corpse, but not so deep that it might never be found. She dragged Beatrice Pym's body from the back of the van and stripped away the bloody clothing. She took hold of the naked corpse by the feet and dragged it closer to the grave. Then the killer walked back to the van and removed 3 items, an iron mallet, a red brick, and a small spade. This was the part she dreaded most, for some reason worse than the murder itself. She dropped the three items next to the body and steadied herself. Fighting off another wave of nausea, she took the mallet in her gloved hand, raised it, and crushed Beatrice Pym's nose. When it was over, she could barely look at what was left of Beatrice Pym's face. Using first the mallet, then the brick, she had pounded it into a mass of blood, tissue, smashed bone, and shattered teeth. She had achieved the intended effect. The features had been erased, the face rendered unrecognizable. She had done everything they had ordered her to do. She was to be different. She had trained at a special camp for many months, much longer than the other agents. She would be planted deeper. That was why she had to kill Beatrice Pym. She wouldn't waste her time doing what other, less gifted agents could do, counting troops, monitoring railways, assessing bomb damage. That was easy. She would be saved for bigger and better things. She would be a time bomb, ticking inside England, waiting to be activated, waiting to go off. She put a boot against the ribs and pushed. The corpse tumbled into the grave. She covered the body with earth. She collected the blood-stained clothing and tossed it into the back of the van. From the front seat she took a small handbag containing a Dutch passport and a wallet. The wallet held identification papers, an Amsterdam driver's permit, and photographs of a fat, smiling Dutch family. All of it had been forged by the Abwehr in Berlin. She threw the bag into the trees at the edge of the barley field, a few yards from the grave. If everything went according to plan, the badly decomposed and mutilated body would be found in a few months, along with the handbag. The police would believe the dead woman to be Christa Kunst, a Dutch tourist who entered the country in October 1938, and whose holiday came to an unfortunate and violent end. Before leaving, she took a last look at the grave. She felt a pang of sadness for Beatrice Pym. In death, she had been robbed of her face and her name. Something else. The killer had just lost her own identity. For 6 months, she had lived in Holland, for Dutch was one of her languages. She had carefully constructed a past, voted in a local Amsterdam election, even permitted herself a young lover, a boy of 19 with a huge appetite and a willingness to learn new things. Now Christa Kunst lay in a shallow grave on the edge of an English barley field. The killer would assume a new identity in the morning. But tonight she was no one. She refueled the van and drove for 20 minutes. The village of Alderton, like Beatrice Pym, had been carefully chosen. A place where a van burning at the roadside in the middle of the night would not be noticed immediately. She pulled the motorbike out of the van along a heavy plank of wood. Difficult work, even for a strong man. She struggled with the bike and gave up when it was 3 feet from the road. It crashed down with a loud bang, the one mistake she had made all night. She lifted the bike and rolled it, engine dead, 50 yards down the road. Then she returned to the van. One of the jerry cans still contained some petrol. She doused the inside of the van, dumping most of the fuel on Beatrice Pym's blood-soaked clothing. By the time the van went up in a fireball, she had kicked the bike into life. She watched the van burn for a few seconds, the orange light dancing on the barren field and the line of trees beyond. Then she turned the bike south and headed for London. Chapter 2. Oyster Bay, New York, August 1939. Dorothy Lauterbach considered her stately fieldstone mansion the most beautiful on the North Shore. Most of her friends agreed, because she was richer, and they wanted invitations to the two parties the Lauterbachs threw each summer, a raucous, drunken affair in June, and a more reflective occasion in late August, when the summer season ground to a melancholy conclusion. The back of the house looked out over the Sound. There was a pleasant beach of white sand, brought by truck from Massachusetts. From the beach, a well-fertilized lawn raced toward the back of the house, pausing now and again to skirt the exquisite gardens, the red clay tennis court, the royal blue swimming pool. The servants had risen early to prepare for the family's well-deserved day of inactivity, erecting a croquet set and a badminton net that would never be touched, removing the canvas cover from a wooden motorboat that would never be untied from the dock. Once a servant courageously pointed out to Mrs. Lauterbach the folly of this daily ritual. Mrs. Lauterbach had snapped at him, and the practice was never again questioned. The toys were raised each and every morning, only to stand with the sadness of Christmas decorations in May, until they were ceremoniously removed at sundown and put away for the night. The bottom floor of the house sprawled along the water from sunroom to sitting room to dining room, and finally to the Florida room, though none of the other Lauterbachs understood why Dorothy insisted on calling it a Florida room when the summer sun on the North Shore could be just as warm. The house had been purchased 30 years earlier, when the young Lauterbachs assumed they would produce a small army of offspring. Instead, they had just 2 daughters who didn't care much for each other's company, Margaret, a beautiful and immensely popular socialite, and Jane. And so the house became a peaceful place of warm sunshine and soft colours, where most of the noise was made by white curtains snapping in watery breezes, and Dorothy Lauterbach's restless pursuit of perfection in all things. On that morning, the morning after the Lauterbach's final party, the curtains hung still and straight in the open windows, waiting for a breeze that would never come. The sun blazed, and a shimmering haze hung over the bay. The air was itchy and thick. Upstairs in her bedroom, Margaret Lauterbach Jordan pulled off her nightgown and sat in front of her dressing table. She quickly brushed her hair. It was ash blonde, streaked by the sun, and unfashionably short. But it was comfortable and easy to manage. Besides, she liked the way it framed her face and showed off the long, graceful line of her neck. She looked at her body in the mirror. She had finally lost the last few stubborn pounds she had gained while pregnant with her first child. The stretch marks had faded, and her stomach was tanned a rich brown. Bare midriffs were in that summer, and she liked the way everyone on the North Shore had been surprised by how trim she looked. Only her breasts were different. They were larger, fine with Margaret, because she had always been self-conscious about their size. The new bras that summer were smaller and stiffer, designed to achieve a high-bosomed effect. Margaret liked them because Peter liked the way they made her look. She pulled on a pair of white cotton slacks, her sleeveless blouse knotted beneath her breasts, and a pair of flat sandals. She looked at her reflection one last time. She was beautiful, she knew that, but not in an audacious way that turned heads on the streets of Manhattan. Margaret's beauty was timeless and understated, perfect for the layer of society into which she had been born. She thought, and soon you're going to be a fat cow again. She turned from the mirror and drew open the curtains. Harsh sunlight spilled into the room. The lawn was in chaos. The tent was being lowered. The caterers were packing away the tables and chairs. The dance floor was being lifted panel by panel and carted away. The grass, once green and lush, had been trampled flat. She opened the windows and smelled the sickly sweet scent of spilled champagne. Something about it depressed her. Hitler may be preparing to conquer Poland, but a glittering time was had by all who attended Bratton and Dorothy Lauterbach's annual August Gala Saturday night. Margaret could almost write the society columns herself by now. She switched on the radio on her nightstand and tuned it to WNYC. "I'll Never Smile Again," played softly. Peter stirred, still asleep. In the brilliant sunlight, his porcelain skin was barely distinguishable from the white satin sheets. Once she thought all engineers were men with flat-top haircuts, thick black glasses and lots of pencils in their shirt pockets. Peter was not like that. Strong cheekbones, a sharp jawline, soft green eyes, nearly black hair. Lying in bed now, his upper body exposed, he looked, Margaret thought, like a tumbled Michelangelo. He stood out on the North Shore, stood out from the fair-haired boys who had been born to extraordinary wealth and planned to live life from a deck chair. Peter was sharp and ambitious and brisk. He could run circles around the whole crowd. Margaret liked that. She glanced at the hazy sky and frowned. Peter detested August weather like this. He would be irritable and cranky all day. There would probably be a thunderstorm to ruin the drive back into the city. She thought, perhaps I should wait to tell him the news. Get up, Peter, or we'll never hear the end of it, Margaret said, poking him with her toe. 5 more minutes. We don't have 5 minutes, darling. Peter didn't move. Coffee, he pleaded. The maids had left coffee outside the bedroom door. It was a practice Dorothy Lauterbach loathed. She thought it made the upstairs hallway look like the Plaza Hotel. But it was allowed if it meant that the children would abide by her single rule on weekends, that they come downstairs for breakfast promptly at 9 o'clock. Margaret poured a cup of coffee and handed it to him. Peter rolled onto his elbow and drank some. Then he sat up in bed and looked at Margaret. How do you manage to look so beautiful 2 minutes after getting out of bed? Margaret was relieved. You're certainly in a good mood. I was afraid you'd have a hangover and be perfectly beastly all day. I do have a hangover. Benny Goodman is playing in my head, and my tongue feels like it could use a shave. But I have no intention of acting... He paused. What was the word you used?
Beastly.
She sat down on the edge of the bed.
There's something we need to discuss, and this seems as fine a time as any.
Sounds serious, Margaret.
That depends.
She held him in her playful gaze, then feigned a look of irritation.
But get up and get dressed.
Or aren't you capable of dressing and listening at the same time? I'm a highly trained, highly regarded engineer. Peter forced himself out of bed, groaning at the effort. I can probably manage it.
It's about the phone call yesterday afternoon.
The one you were so evasive about?
Yes, that one. It was from Dr. Shipman.
Peter stopped dressing.
I'm pregnant again. We're going to have another baby.
Margaret looked down and toyed with the knot of her blouse.
I didn't plan for this to happen. It just did. My body has finally recovered from having Billy and, well, nature took its course.
She looked up at him.
I've suspected it for some time, but I was afraid to tell you.
Why on earth would you be afraid to tell me? But Peter knew the answer to his own question. He had told Margaret he didn't want more children until he had realized his life's dream, starting his own engineering firm. At just 33, he had earned a reputation as one of the top engineers in the country. After graduating first in his class from the prestigious Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, he went to work for the Northeast Bridge Company, the largest bridge construction firm on the East Coast. 5 years later, he was named chief engineer, made partner, and given a staff of 100. The American Society of Civil Engineers named him its Engineer of the Year for 1938 for his innovative work on a bridge spanning the Hudson River in upstate New York. Scientific American published a profile on Peter describing his as the most promising engineering mind of his generation. But he wanted more. He wanted his own firm. Bratton Lauterbach had promised to bankroll Peter's company when the time was right, possibly next year. But the threat of war had put a damper on all that. If the United States was dragged into a war, all money for major public works projects would dry up overnight. Peter's new firm would go under before it had a chance to get off the ground. He said, "How far along are you?"
"Almost 2 months."
Peter's face broke into a smile. Margaret said,
"You're not angry with me?"
"Of course not!
What about your firm and everything you said about waiting to have more children?"
He kissed her. "It doesn't matter. None of it matters."
"Ambition is a wonderful thing, but not too much ambition. You have to relax and enjoy yourself sometimes, Peter. Life isn't a dress rehearsal."
Peter stood and finished dressing. "When are you planning on telling your mother?"
"In my own good time.
You remember how she was when I was pregnant with Billy?
She drove me crazy. I have plenty of time to tell her."
Peter sat down beside her on the bed. "Let's make love before breakfast."
"Peter, we can't. Mother will kill us if we don't get downstairs."
He kissed her neck.
What was that you were saying about life not being a dress rehearsal?
She closed her eyes. Her head rolled back.
That's not fair. You're twisting my words.
No, I'm not. I'm kissing you.
Yes. Margaret?
Dorothy Lauterbach's voice echoed up the stairs.
We're coming, Mother.
I wish, Peter muttered, and followed her downstairs to breakfast. Walker Hardigan joined them for lunch by the swimming pool. They sat beneath an umbrella. Bratton and Dorothy, Margaret and Peter, Jane and Hardigan. A damp, fickle breeze blew from the sound. Hardigan was Bratton Lauterbach's top lieutenant at the bank. He was tall and thick through the chest and shoulders, and most women thought he looked like Tyrone Power. He was a Harvard man, and during his senior year he had scored a touchdown in the Yale game. His football days had left him with a ruined knee and a slight limp that somehow made him even more attractive. He had a lazy New England accent and smiled easily. A short time after Hardigan came to the bank, he asked Margaret out, and they dated several times. Hardigan wanted the relationship to continue, but Margaret did not. She quietly terminated it, but still saw Walker regularly at parties, and they remained friends. 6 months later, she met Peter and fell in love. Hardigan was beside himself. One evening at the Copacabana, a little drunk and very jealous, he cornered Margaret and begged her to see him again. When she refused, he grabbed her too roughly by the shoulder and shook her. By the icy look on her face, Margaret made it clear she would destroy his career if he did not end his childish behavior. The incident remained their secret. Even Peter didn't know. Hardigan rose quickly through the ranks and became Bratton's most trusted senior officer. Margaret sensed there was an unspoken tension between Hardigan and Peter, a natural competitiveness. Both were young, handsome, intelligent, and successful. The situation had worsened earlier that summer when Peter discovered Hardigan was opposed to lending the money for his engineering firm. "I am not one who usually goes in for Wagner, especially in the current climate," Hardigan said, pausing to sip his chilled white wine while everyone chuckled at his remark. "But you really must see Herbert Janssen in Tannhäuser at the Metropolitan. It's marvelous."
"I've heard such good things about it," Dorothy said. She loved to discuss the opera, theatre, and new books and films.
Hardigan, who managed to see and read everything despite an immense workload at the bank, indulged her. The arts were safe topics, unlike family matters and gossip, which Dorothy deplored.
"We did see Ethel Merman in the new Cole Porter musical," Dorothy said, as the first course, a cold shrimp salad, was served. "The title slips my mind."
"Du Barry was a lady," Hardigan put in. "I loved it." Hardigan continued talking. He had gone to Forest Hills yesterday afternoon and watched Bobby Riggs win his match. He thought Riggs was a sure thing to win the Open this year. Margaret watched her mother, who was watching Hardigan. Dorothy adored Hardigan, practically treating him like a member of the family. She had made it clear that she preferred Hardigan to Peter. Hardigan was from a wealthy, conservative family in Maine, not as rich as the Lauterbachs, but close enough for comfort. Peter came from a lower-middle-class Irish family and grew up on the west side of Manhattan. He might be a brilliant engineer, but he would never be one of us. The dispute threatened to destroy Margaret's relationship with her mother. It was ended by Bratton, who would tolerate no objections to his daughter's choice of a husband. Margaret had married Peter in a storybook wedding at St. James's Episcopal Church in June 1935. Hardigan was among the 600 invited guests. He danced with Margaret during the reception and behaved like a perfect gentleman. He even stayed to see the couple off on their 2-month honeymoon in Europe. It was as if the incident at the Copa never happened. The servants brought the main course, chilled poached salmon, and the conversation inevitably shifted to the looming war in Europe. Bratton said,
"Is there any way of stopping Hitler now? Or is Poland about to become the easternmost province of the Third Reich?"
Hardigan, a lawyer as well as a shrewd investor, had been placed in charge of disentangling the bank from its German and other risky European investments. Inside the bank, he was affectionately referred to as our in-house Nazi,
because of his name, his perfect German, and his frequent trips to Berlin. He also maintained a network of excellent contacts in Washington and served as the bank's chief intelligence officer.
"I spoke to a friend of mine this morning. He's on Henry Stimson's staff in the War Department," Hardigan said. "When Roosevelt returned to Washington from his cruise on the Tuscaloosa, Stimson met him at Union Station and rode with him to the White House. When Roosevelt asked him about the situation in Europe, Stimson replied that the days of peace could now be counted on the fingers of both hands."
"Roosevelt returned to Washington a week ago," Margaret said.
"That's right. Do the math yourself. And I think Stimson was being optimistic. I think war could be hours away.
But what about this communication I read about this morning in the Times?" Peter asked. Hitler had sent a message to Britain the previous night, and the Times suggested it might pave the way for a negotiated settlement of the Polish crisis.
"I think he's stalling," Hardigan said. "The Germans have 60 divisions along the Polish border, waiting for the word to move."
"So what's Hitler waiting for?" Margaret asked.
"An excuse.
Certainly the Poles aren't going to give him an excuse to invade."
"No, of course not. But that won't stop Hitler."
"What are you suggesting, Walker?"
Bratton asked. "Hitler will invent a reason to attack, a provocation that will allow him to invade without a declaration of war."
"What about the British and the French?" Peter asked. "Will they live up to their commitments to declare war on Germany if Poland is attacked?"
"I believe so."
"They didn't stop Hitler at the Rhineland, or Austria, or Czechoslovakia," Peter said.
"Yes, but Poland is different. Britain and France now realize Hitler must be dealt with."
"What about us?" Margaret asked. "Can we stay out?"
"Roosevelt insists he wants to stay on the sidelines," Bratton said. "But I don't trust him. If the whole of Europe slides into war, I doubt if we'll be able to stay out of it for long."
"And the bank?" Margaret asked.
"We're terminating all our deals with German interests," Hardigan replied. "If there is a war, there will be plenty of other opportunities for investment. This war may be just what we need to finally pull the country out of the depression."
"Ah, nothing like earning a profit from death and destruction," Jane said. Margaret frowned at her younger sister and thought, typical Jane. She liked to portray herself as an iconoclast, a dark, brooding intellectual, critical of her class and everything it represented. At the same time, she socialized relentlessly and spent her father's money as if the well were about to run dry. At 30, she had no means of support and no prospects for marriage.
"Oh, Jane, have you been reading Marx again?" Margaret asked playfully.
"Margaret, please," Dorothy said. "Jane spent time in England a few years ago," Margaret continued, as though she had not heard her mother's plea for peace. "She became quite a communist then, didn't you, Jane?"
"I'm entitled to an opinion, Margaret," Jane snapped. "Hitler's not running this house."
"I think I'd like to become a communist, too," Margaret said. "The summer has been rather dull, with all this talk of war. Converting to communism would be a nice change of pace. The Huttons are throwing a costume party next weekend. We could go as Lenin and Stalin. After the party, we'll go out to the North Fork and collectivize all the farms. It will be great fun." Bratton, Peter, and Hardigan burst into laughter.
"Thank you, Margaret," Dorothy said sternly. "You've entertained us all quite enough for one day."
The talk of war had gone on long enough. Dorothy reached out and touched Hardigan's arm.
"Walker, I'm so sorry you couldn't come to our party last night. It was wonderful. Let me tell you all about it."
The lavish apartment on Fifth Avenue overlooking Central Park had been a wedding present from Bratton Lauterbach. At 7 o'clock that evening, Peter Jordan stood at the window. A thunderstorm had moved in over the city. Lightning flashed over the deep green treetops of the park. The wind drove rain against the glass. Peter had driven back into the city alone because Dorothy had insisted that Margaret attend a garden party at Edith Blakemore's. Margaret was being driven back into the city by Wiggins, the Lauterbach's chauffeur, and now they were going to be caught in the bad weather. Peter shoved out his arm and glanced at his watch for the fifth time in 5 minutes. He was supposed to meet the head of the Pennsylvania Road and Bridge Commission at the Stork Club for dinner at 7:30. Pennsylvania was accepting bids and design proposals for a new bridge over the Allegheny River. Peter's boss wanted him to lock up the deal tonight. He was often called on to entertain clients. He was young and smart, and his beautiful wife was the daughter of one of the most powerful bankers in the country. They were an impressive couple. He thought, where the hell is she? He telephoned the Oyster Bay house and spoke to Dorothy.
I don't know what to say to you, Peter. She left in plenty of time. Perhaps Wiggins was delayed by the weather. You know, Wiggins, one sign of rain and he slows to a crawl.
I'll give her another 15 minutes. Then I have to leave. Peter knew Dorothy wouldn't apologize, so he hung up before there could be an awkward moment of silence. He made himself a gin and tonic and drank it very fast while he waited. At 7:15, he took the elevator downstairs and stood in the lobby while the doorman went out into the rain and flagged down a taxi.
When my wife arrives, ask her to come directly to the Stork Club.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jordan.
The dinner went well, despite the fact that Peter left the table 3 times to telephone the apartment and the Oyster Bay house. By 8:30, he was no longer annoyed. He was worried sick. At 8:45 p.m., Paul Delano, the head waiter, presented himself at Peter's table.
You have a telephone call at the bar, sir.
Thanks, Paul. Peter excused himself. At the bar, he had to raise his voice above the clinking glasses and the din of conversation.
Peter! It's Jane.
Peter heard her voice tremble.
What's wrong?
I'm afraid there's been an accident.
Where are you?
I'm with the Nassau County Police.
What happened?
A car pulled in front of them on the highway. Wiggins couldn't see it in the rain. By the time he did, it was too late.
Oh, God!
Wiggins is in very bad shape. The doctors aren't holding up much hope for him.
What about Margaret, dammit?
Lauterbach did not cry at funerals. Grieving was done in private. It was held at St. James's Episcopal Church, the same church where Peter and Margaret had been married 4 years earlier. President Roosevelt sent a note of condolence and expressed his disappointment that he could not attend. Most of New York society did attend. So did most of the financial world, even though the markets were in turmoil. Germany had invaded Poland, and the world was waiting for the other shoe to drop. Billy stood next to Peter during the service. He wore short pants and a little blazer and tie. As the family filed out of the church, he reached up and tugged on the hem of his Aunt Jane's black dress.
Will Mommy ever come home?
No, Billy, she won't. She's left us.
Edith Blakemore overheard the child's question and burst into tears.
What a tragedy!
She gasped, sobbing.
What a needless tragedy!
Margaret was buried under brilliant skies in the family plot on Long Island. During the Reverend Pugh's final words, a murmur passed through the graveside mourners, then died away. When it was over, Peter walked back to the limousines with his best friend, Shepherd Ramsey. Shepherd had introduced Peter to Margaret. Even in his somber dark suit, he looked as though he'd just stepped off the deck of his sailboat.
What was everyone talking about? Peter asked. It was damned rude.
Someone arrived late, and they'd been listening to a bulletin on the car radio, Shepherd said. The British and French just declared war on Germany.
Chapter 3. London, May 1940. Professor Alfred Vickery vanished without explanation from University College on the third Friday of May, 1940. A secretary named Lillian Walford was the last member of the staff to see him before his abrupt departure. In a rare indiscretion, she revealed to the other professors that Vickery's last telephone call had been from the new Prime Minister. In fact, she had spoken to Mr. Churchill personally.
Same thing happened to Masterman and Cheney at Oxford.
Tom Perrington, an Egyptologist, said, as he gazed at the entry in the telephone log,
"Mysterious calls, men in dark suits.
I suspect our dear friend Alfred has slipped behind the veil.
Then he added, sotto voce, into the secret Acropolis. Perrington's languid smile did little to hide his disappointment, Miss Walford would remark later. Too bad Britain wasn't at war with the ancient Egyptians. Perhaps Perrington would have been chosen too. Vickery spent his last hours in the cramped, disorderly office overlooking Gordon Square, putting the final touches on an article for the Sunday Times. The current crisis might have been avoided, it suggested, if Britain and France had attacked Germany in 1939, while Hitler still was preoccupied with Poland. He knew it would be roundly criticized, given the current climate. His last piece had been denounced as Churchillian warmongering by a publication of the pro-Nazi extreme right. Vickery secretly hoped his new article would be similarly received. It was a glorious late spring day, bright sunshine but deceptively chilly. Vickery, an accomplished if reluctant chess player, appreciated deception. He rose, put on a cardigan sweater, and resumed his work. The fine weather painted a false picture. Britain was a nation under siege, defenseless, frightened, reeling in utter confusion. Plans were drawn up to evacuate the royal family to Canada. The government asked that Britain's other national treasure, its children, be sent into the countryside, where they would be safe from the Luftwaffe's bombers. Through the use of skilled propaganda, the government had made the general public extremely aware of the threat posed by spies and fifth columnists. It was now reaping the consequences. Constabularies were being buried by reports of strangers, odd-looking fellows, or German-looking gentlemen. Citizens were eavesdropping on conversations in pubs, hearing what they liked, then telling the police. They reported smoke signals, winking shore lights, and parachuting spies. A rumor swept the country that German agents posed as nuns during the invasion of the Low Countries. Suddenly, nuns were suspect. Most left the walled sanctuary of their convents only when absolutely necessary. 1 million men too young, too old, or too feeble to get into the armed forces rushed to join the Home Guard. There were no extra rifles for the Guard, so they armed themselves with whatever they could. Shotguns, swords, broom handles, medieval bludgeons, Gurkha knives, even golf clubs. Those who somehow couldn't find a suitable weapon were instructed to carry pepper to toss into the eyes of marauding German soldiers. Vickery, a noted historian, watched his nation's jittery preparations for war with a mixture of enormous pride and quiet depression. Throughout the 30s, his periodic newspaper articles and lectures had warned that Hitler posed a serious threat to England and the rest of the world. But Britain, exhausted from the last war with the Germans, had been in no mood to hear about another. Now the German army was driving across France with the ease of a weekend motor outing. Soon Adolf Hitler would stand atop an empire stretching from the Arctic Circle to the Mediterranean, and Britain, poorly armed and ill-prepared, stood alone against him. Vickery finished the article, set down his pencil, and read it from the beginning. Outside, the sun was setting into a sea of orange over London. The smell of the crocuses and daffodils in the gardens of Gordon Square drifted in his window. The afternoon had turned colder. The flowers were likely to set off a sneezing fit, but the breeze felt wonderful on his face, and somehow made the tea taste better. He left the window open and enjoyed it. The war, it was making him think and act differently. It was making him look more fondly upon his countrymen, whom he usually viewed with something approaching despair. He marveled at how they made jokes while filing into the shelter of the underground, and at the way they sang in pubs to hide their fear. It took Vickery some time to recognize his feelings for what they were. Patriotism. During his lifetime of study, he had concluded it was the most destructive force on the planet, but now he felt the stirring of patriotism in his own chest, and did not feel ashamed. We are good, and they are evil. Our nationalism is justified. Vickery had decided he wanted to contribute. He wanted to do something instead of watching the world through his well-guarded window. At 6 o'clock, Lillian Walford entered without knocking. She was tall, with a shot-putter's legs, and round glasses that magnified an unfaltering gaze. She began straightening papers and closing books with the quiet efficiency of a night nurse. Nominally, Miss Walford was assigned to all the professors in the department, but she believed that God, in his infinite wisdom, entrusted each of us with one soul to look after. And if any poor soul needed looking after, it was Professor Vickery. For 10 years, she had overseen the details of Vickery's uncomplicated life with military precision. She made certain there was food at his house in Draycott Place in Chelsea. She saw that his shirts were delivered and contained the right amount of starch. Not too much, or it would irritate the soft skin of his neck. She saw to his bills and lectured him regularly about the state of his poorly managed bank account. She hired new maids with seasonal regularity because his fits of bad temper drove away the old ones. Despite the closeness of their working relationship, they never referred to each other by their Christian names. She was Miss Walford, and he was Professor Vickery. She preferred to be called a personal assistant, and, uncharacteristically, Vickery indulged her. Miss Walford brushed past Vickery and closed the window, casting him a scolding look. "If you don't mind, Professor Vickery, I'll be going home for the evening." "Of course, Miss Walford." He looked up at her. He was a fussy, bookish little man, bald on top except for a few uncontrollable strands of grey hair. His long-suffering half-moon reading glasses rested on the end of his nose. They were smudged with fingerprints because of his habit of taking them on and off whenever he was nervous. He wore a weather-beaten tweed coat and a carelessly selected tie stained with tea. His walk was something of a joke around the university. Without his knowledge, some of his students had learned to imitate it perfectly. A shattered knee during the last war had left him with a stiff-jointed, mechanized limp, a toy soldier no longer in good working order, Miss Walford thought. His head tended to tilt down, so he could see over his reading glasses, and he seemed forever rushing somewhere he'd rather not be. "Mr. Ashworth delivered 2 nice lamb chops to your house a short time ago," Miss Walford said, frowning at a messy stack of papers as though it were an unruly child. "He said it may be the last lamb he gets for some time."
"I should think so," said Vickery. "There hasn't been meat on the menu at the Connaught in weeks."
"It's getting a little absurd, don't you think, Professor Vickery? Today the government decreed the tops of London's buses should be painted battleship grey," Miss Walford said. "They think it will make it more difficult for the Luftwaffe to bomb them."
"The Germans are ruthless, Miss Walford, but even they won't waste their time trying to bomb passenger buses."
"They've also decreed that we should not shoot carrier pigeons. Would you please explain to me how I'm supposed to tell a carrier pigeon from a real one?"
"I can't tell you how often I'm tempted to shoot pigeons," Vickery said.
"By the way, I took the liberty of ordering you some mint sauce as well," Miss Walford said. "I know how eating lamb chops without mint sauce can destroy your week."
"Thank you, Miss Walford."
"Your publisher rang to say the proofs of the new book are ready for you to examine."
"And only 4 weeks late. A record for Cagley. Remind me to find a new publisher, Miss Walford."
"Yes, Professor Vickery. Miss Simpson telephoned to say she'll be unable to have dinner with you tonight. Her mother has taken ill. She asked me to tell you it's nothing serious."
"Damn,"
Vickery muttered. He had been looking forward to the date with Alice Simpson. It was the most serious he had been about a woman in a very long time.
"Is that all?"
"No. The Prime Minister telephoned."
"What? Why on earth didn't you tell me?"
"You left strict instructions not to be disturbed. When I told this to Mr. Churchill, he was quite understanding. He says nothing upsets him more than being interrupted when he's writing."
Vickery frowned. "From now on, Miss Walford, you have my explicit permission to interrupt me when Mr. Churchill telephones."
"Yes, Professor Vickery," she replied, undeterred in her belief that she had acted properly.
"What did the Prime Minister say?"
"You're expected for lunch tomorrow at Chartwell." Vickery varied his walks home according to his mood. Sometimes he preferred to jostle along a busy shopping street or through the buzzing crowds of Soho. Other nights he left the main thoroughfares and roamed the quiet residential streets, now pausing to gaze at a splendidly lit example of Georgian architecture, now slowing to listen to the sounds of music, laughter, and clinking glass, drifting from a happy cocktail party.
Tonight he floated along a quiet street through the dying twilight. Before the war, he had spent most nights doing research at the library, wandering the stacks like a ghost late into the evening. Some nights he fell asleep. Miss Walford issued instructions to the night janitors. When they found him, he was to be awakened, tucked into his Macintosh, and sent home for the night. The blackout had changed that. Each night, the city plunged into pitch darkness. Native Londoners lost their way along streets they had walked for years. For Vickery, who suffered from night blindness, the blackout made navigation next to impossible. He imagined this is what it must have been like 2 millennia ago, when London was a clump of log huts along the swampy banks of the River Thames. Time had dissolved, the centuries retreated, man's undeniable progress brought to a halt by the threat of Goering's bombers. Each afternoon, Vickery fled the college and rushed home before becoming stranded on the darkened side streets of Chelsea. Once safely inside his home, he drank his statutory 2 glasses of burgundy and consumed the plate of chop and peas his maid left for him in a warm oven. Had they not prepared his meals, he might have starved, for he still was grappling with the complexities of the modern English kitchen. After dinner, some music, a play on the wireless, even a detective novel, a private obsession he shared with no one. Vickery liked mysteries. He liked riddles. He liked to use his powers of reasoning and deduction to solve the cases long before the author did it for him. He also liked the character studies in mysteries, and often found parallels to his own work. Why good people sometimes did wicked things. Sleep was a progressive affair. It began in his favorite chair, reading lamp still burning. Then he would move to the couch. Then, usually in the hours just before dawn, he would march upstairs to his bedroom. Sometimes the concentration required to remove his clothes would leave him too alert to fall back to sleep. So he would lie awake and think and wait for the gray dawn and the snicker of the old magpie that splashed about each morning in the birdbath outside in the garden. He doubted he would sleep much tonight. Not after the summons from Churchill. It was not unusual for Churchill to ring him at the office. It was just the timing. Vickery and Churchill had been friends since the autumn of 1935, when Vickery attended a lecture delivered by Churchill in London. Churchill, confined to the wilderness of the back bench, was one of the few voices in Britain warning of the threat posed by the Nazis. That night he claimed Germany was rearming herself at a feverish pace, that Hitler intended to fight as soon as he was capable. England must rearm at once, he argued, or face enslavement by the Nazis. The audience thought Churchill had lost his mind and heckled him mercilessly. Churchill had cut short his remarks and returned to Chartwell, mortified. Vickery stood at the back of the lecture hall that night, watching the spectacle. He, too, had been observing Germany carefully since Hitler's rise to power. He had quietly predicted to his colleagues that England and Germany would soon be at war, perhaps before the end of the decade. No one listened. Many people thought Hitler was a fine counterbalance to the Soviet Union and should be supported. Vickery thought that utter nonsense. Like the rest of the country, he considered Churchill a bit of an adventurer, a bit too bellicose. But when it came to the Nazis, Vickery believed Churchill was dead on target. Returning home, Vickery sat at his desk and jotted him a one-sentence note. I attended your lecture in London and agree with every word you uttered. 5 days later, a note from Churchill arrived at Vickery's home. My God, I am not alone after all. The great Vickery is at my side. Please do me the honour of coming to Chartwell for lunch this Sunday. Their first meeting was a success. Vickery was immediately absorbed into the ring of academics, journalists, civil servants, and military officers who would give Churchill advice and intelligence on Germany for the rest of the decade. Winston forced Vickery to listen while he paced the ancient wooden floor of his library and explained his theories about German intentions. Sometimes Vickery disagreed, forcing Churchill to clarify his positions. Sometimes Churchill lost his temper and refused to back down. Vickery would hold his ground. Their friendship was cemented in this manner. Now, walking through the gathering dusk, Vickery thought of Churchill's summons to Chartwell.
It certainly wasn't just to have a friendly chat. Vickery turned into a street lined with white Georgian terraces, painted rose by the last minutes of the spring twilight. He walked slowly, as if lost, one hand clutching his leaden briefcase, the other rammed into his Macintosh pocket. An attractive woman, roughly his age, emerged from a doorway. A handsome man with a bored face followed her. Even from a distance, even with his dreadful eyesight, he could see it was Helen. He would recognize her anywhere, the erect carriage, the long neck, the disdainful walk, as if she were always about to step into something disagreeable. Vickery watched them climb into the back of the chauffeur-driven car. It drew away from the curb and headed in his direction. "Turn away, you damned fool, don't look at her." But he was incapable of heeding his own advice. As the car passed, he turned his head and looked into the rear seat. She saw him, just for an instant, but it was long enough. Embarrassed, she looked quickly down. Vickery, through the rear window of the car, watched her turn and murmur something to her husband that made his head snap back with laughter. "Idiot! Bloody damned idiot!" Vickery started walking again. He looked up and watched the car vanish around a corner. He wondered where they were headed. Off to another party. The theatre, maybe. "Why can't I just let her go? It's been 25 years, for God's sake." And then he thought, "And why is your heart beating like it was the first time you saw her face?" He walked as fast as he could until he grew tired and out of breath. He thought of anything that came into his mind, anything but her. He came to a playground and stood at the wrought iron gate, staring through the bars at the children. They were overdressed for May, bumping around like tiny plump penguins. Any German spy lurking about would surely realize many Londoners had discounted the government's warning and kept their children with them in the city. Vickery, normally indifferent to children, stood at the gate and listened, mesmerized, thinking there was nothing quite so comforting as the sound of little ones at play. Churchill's car was waiting for him at the station. It sped top down through the rolling green countryside of southeast England. The day was cool and breezy, and it seemed everything was in bloom. Vickery sat in back, one hand holding his coat closed, the other pressing his hat to his head. Wind blew over the open car like a gale over the prow of a ship. He debated whether he should ask the driver to stop and put up the top. Then the inevitable sneezing fit began, at first like sporadic sniper fire, then progressing into a full-fledged barrage. Vickery couldn't decide which hand to free to cover his mouth. He repeatedly pivoted his head and sneezed so the little puffs of moisture and germs were carried away by the wind. The driver saw Vickery's gyrations in the mirror and became alarmed. "Would you like me to stop the car, Professor Vickery?" he asked, easing off the throttle. The sneezing attack subsided, and Vickery was actually able to enjoy the ride. He didn't care for the countryside, as a rule. He was a Londoner. He liked the crowds and the noise and the traffic, and tended to get disoriented in open spaces. He also hated the quiet of the nights. His mind wandered, and he became convinced there were stalkers roaming in the darkness. But now he sat back in the car and marveled at England's natural beauty. The car turned into the drive at Chartwell. Vickery's pulse quickened as he stepped from the car. As he approached the door, it opened, and Churchill's man, Inches, stood there to greet him. "Good morning, Professor Vickery. The Prime Minister has been awaiting your arrival most eagerly." Vickery handed over his coat and his hat and stepped inside. About a dozen men and a couple of young girls were at work in the drawing room, some in uniform, some like Vickery in civilian clothes. They spoke in hushed, confessional tones, as though all the news was bad. A telephone rattled, then another. Each was answered after one ring. "I hope you had a pleasant trip," Inches was saying. "Marvellous," Vickery replied, lying politely. "As usual, Mr. Churchill is running late this morning," Inches said. Then he added confidingly, "He sets an unattainable schedule, and we all spend the rest of the day trying to catch up with it." "I understand, Inches. Where would you like me to wait?" "Actually, the Prime Minister is quite eager to see you this morning. He asked that you be shown upstairs immediately upon your arrival." "Upstairs?" Inches knocked gently and pushed open the bathroom door. Churchill lay in his tub, a cigar in one hand, the day's second glass of whiskey resting on a small table within easy reach. Inches announced Vickery and withdrew.
"Vickery, my dear man,"
Churchill said. He put his mouth at the waterline and blew bubbles.
"How good of you to come!"
Vickery found the warm temperature of the bathroom oppressive. He also found it hard not to laugh at the enormous pink man splashing about in his bath like a child. He removed his tweed jacket and reluctantly sat down on the toilet.
"I wanted a word with you in private. That's why I've invited you here to my lair."
Churchill pursed his lips.
"Vickery, I must admit from the outset that I am angry with you."
Vickery stiffened. Churchill opened his mouth to continue, then stopped himself. A perplexed, defeated look dawned over his face.
"Inches!"
he bellowed. Inches drifted in.
"Yes, Mr. Churchill?"
"Inches! I believe my bathwater has dropped below 104 degrees. Would you check the thermometer?"
Rolling up his sleeve, Inches retrieved the thermometer. He studied it like an archaeologist examining an ancient bone fragment.
"Ah, you're right, sir. The temperature of your bath has plummeted to 102 degrees. Shall I warm it?"
"Well, of course."
Inches opened the hot water tap and let it run for a moment. Churchill smiled as his bath water attained its proper temperature.
"Much better, Inches."
Churchill rolled onto his side. Water cascaded over the side of the tub, soaking the leg of Vickery's trousers.
"You were saying, Prime Minister?" "Ah, yes, I was saying, Vickery, that I was angry with you. You never told me that in your younger days you were quite good at chess. Beat all comers at Cambridge, so I'm told."
Vickery, thoroughly confused, said, "I apologize, Prime Minister, but the subject of chess never arose during any of our conversations."
"Brilliant, ruthless, gambling. That's how people have described your play to me."
Churchill paused.
"You also served in the Intelligence Corps in the First War."
"I was only in the motorcycle unit. I was a courier, nothing more." Churchill turned his gaze from Vickery and stared at the ceiling.
"In 1250 BC, the Lord told Moses to send agents to spy out the land of Canaan. The Lord was good enough to give Moses some advice on how to recruit his spies. Only the best and the brightest men were capable of such an important task, the Lord said, and Moses took his words to heart."
"This is true, Prime Minister," Vickery said. "But it is also true that the intelligence gathered by the spies of Moses was poorly utilized. As a result, the Israelites spent another 40 years wandering the desert." Churchill smiled.
"I should have learned long ago never to argue with you, Alfred. You have a nimble mind. I've always admired that."
"What is it you want me to do?"
"I want you to take a job in military intelligence."
"But, Prime Minister, I'm not qualified for that sort of..."
"Nobody over there knows what they're doing,"
Churchill said, cutting Vickery off.
"Especially the professional officers."
"But what about my students? My research?"
"Your students will be in the service soon, fighting for their lives. And as for your research, it can wait."
Churchill paused.
"Do you know John Masterman and Christopher Cheney from Oxford?"
"Don't tell me they've been pulled in."
"Indeed. And don't expect to find a mathematician worth his salt at any of the universities," Churchill said. "They've all been snatched up and bundled off to Bletchley Park."
"What on earth are they doing there?"
"Trying to crack German ciphers."
Vickery made a brief show of thought.
"I suppose I accept."
"Good." Churchill thumped his fist on the side of the tub.
"You're to report first thing Monday to Brigadier Sir Basil Boothby. He is the head of the division to which you will be assigned. He is also the complete English ass. He'd thwart me if he could, but he's too stupid for that. Man could fuck up a steel ball."
"Sounds charming."
"He knows you and I are friends, and therefore he will oppose you. Don't allow yourself to be bullied by him. Understood?"
Yes, Prime Minister.
I need someone I can trust inside that department. It's time to put the intelligence back in military intelligence. Besides, this will be good for you, Alfred. It's time you emerged from your dusty library and rejoined the living.
Vickery was caught off guard by Churchill's sudden intimacy. He thought of the previous evening, of his walk home, of staring into Helen's passing car.
Yes, Prime Minister, I believe it is time. Just what will I do for military intelligence?
But Churchill had vanished below the waterline.